Well, I'm pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Dr. Brad Pettit. Welcome, Brad.
Good to be back, Michael. It has been a while, hasn't it?
Has been a while. You may have been the mayor last time we chatted.
I think so. Yeah.
So tell our listeners when you were first elected to the upper house of the state parliament.
Well, 4 years ago, pretty much to the day, was when... Well, actually, it was a bit longer because the 2021 election was... it was a landslide in McGowan, and all of my Greens colleagues lost their seats, and I was a newbie coming in, and I had to wait until, I think it was pretty much mid-April, until I knew that I was in. So this is very painful. Like, I think it was a 5 week wait I had between the election and actually knowing. So so it was nice this time to have to know on the night that I was returned.
Well, I've been feeling very sorry for both Simone McGurk and Kate Hewlett, who had to sort of tough it out for days and days and days.
It's excruciating. It really, I felt for both of them as well. There's no fun in not knowing what your future looks like.
Well, it's been a fascinating election. I've really been taken with it. The composition of the new parliament is very interesting because the upper house is different. There's a new system of voting, and you basically get in on a quota. There's 37 seats. And I keep talking to my colleague Martin Drum on View from the Roundhouse on this topic, but what's your take on the numbers? How do you think it'll finish up looking?
Yeah, so actually I think it's going to be a much more interesting parliament. So the last one, just for context, was Labor had a big majority, 21 out of the 36 seats. So it meant there was, frankly, no debates and no amendments, really, of any meaning in the last parliament. But this one, starting on May the 22nd, when the new upper house starts, will be very different. So Labor will be reduced to 15 or 16, probably 16. And the Greens are looking very likely to get 4. And that in itself becomes very interesting because obviously you need 19 to get something through, but Labor will need to lose one for the president.
So that has to be borne in mind.
Yes.
And how will the Libs and the Nats finish up in all of this?
So I expect the Libs will probably end up on about 11, and Nats will only get 2, which is interesting, because it is so proportional. And people probably, I mean, given they've been the official opposition for the last parliament, people might be surprised to realise they only get about 5 or 6% of the vote. So it's actually quite a small percentage, but their vote's quite concentrated in key areas, which is why they get the lower house seats in the way that we don't.
And that leaves 4 or so other upper house seats. Who's going to finish up?
Yeah.
The Cannabis Party, One Nation.
So Cannabis will, Brian Walker, he will be returned, so just with one. We think that the Australian Christians will end up with one, One Nation will end up with one. And then the last one is no one's really sure. And there will be this, what they call under the line voting, where it's not many, probably 2 or 3% of people take the time to individually number all those people under the line. And we won't know that until literally they press the button, probably early April, who number 37 in the Legislative Council is.
There's a lot of small parties and we won't go through them all. But so another one of them is likely to get up.
Yeah, or could be an independent even. So there was a group of independents, I think they called themselves Group M, which included Aussie Trump, formerly known as Ben Dawkins, and Sophia Mormond and a few others. So one of them will probably get up.
Excuse me. So coughing with excitement about this new, perhaps unpredictable. I mean, the Conservative forces I've heard commenting on the composition of the upper house are worried that the Greens are just going to control government. Others point out, as my colleague Martin Drum has, that all those minor parties that you've just referred to could become the, I was going to use bedfellows, that's the wrong expression, the friends of Labor and all agree to Labor's requirements to get legislation through. Have you got any expectations about how this is going to work?
It's going to be, I don't, because I think it's going to be, we're going to wait and see how Labor choose to play this. And this is actually up to Labor. I mean, you would assume that Labor as a centre-left, progressive-leaning party would want to side with another progressive party to pass progressive legislation. And that's what I hope the reality is, and then that they will come and talk to us as a block of Greens who will we'll work together. We'll seek some amendments to make legislation better and we'll get on and pass it. But Labor may decide not to do that. In fact, I suspect that the majority of legislation will go through with Labor and Liberal support. That was certainly the last parliament. If you go back and look at the last parliament, over 95% of bills had Labor and Liberal both voting for them.
Brad, there's four of you, as we've commented, but we've conspicuously not identified your three colleagues. Tell us about them.
Yeah. Well, look, I've got three really good people who'll be joining me in the parliament. So I was number one on the Up House ticket. Number two was Sophie McNeil, who many of you would know from an ABC journalist.
And from a wonderful podcast with her on Freeman and Shipping.
Yes, you did indeed. Look, she's great and lives just in Hammy Hill. And yeah, an extraordinarily energetic, fearless advocate for human rights and environment, and very smart, very switched on. Feel very lucky to have her joining us in the parliament. So that's really exciting. So she'll be starting on May the 22nd alongside Tim Clifford, who was in the parliament between 2017 and 2021 as the member for East Metropolitan then. And Tim is a really strong housing advocate. And he brings that experience of the former parliament in. And then Jess Beckling, who, again, another really talented person, formerly the head of West Australian Forest Alliance, WAFA, and also the Conservation Council, WA, the director there. She's really, really smart, really knows her issues. So between us, we've got this really nice fit of our kind of areas of expertise and things as well, which is great.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, if you go back, people who've studied the Greens know they were, in a sense, a protest party coming out of environment, coming out of nuclear protests. But then, like all Green parties around the world, had to develop more branches on their trunk. Yeah. And you've mentioned the interests of the four of you. It does start to look that way. How do you go about it? Do you look at the government and all the portfolios and say, Brad, I'll put my hand up and I'll do these ones?
Yeah, well, I think you can have a bit of a scoop here. We're going to take it to the State Council of the Greens tomorrow, the new portfolios that we've all got. But we've all agreed on those. And it was really interesting to me. It was great because we actually... there was not much discussion really because we all knew it. So we've got all the Greens policies and we've got all the government portfolios. We basically put those into the four different packages. So obviously Jess will start with all the environment, forests, regional. She lives in the southwest, so she have all of those kind of issues. Tim also has a union background, so he'll be doing a lot of the union stuff. And the renters' rights and that kind of stuff that he's really good in. Tim also has got health, and Sophie's got education as well as the stuff that she's really strong on around fossil fuels and kind of the key climate, how we stop those climate bombs. And then as my background in local government and planning, I've got energy, planning, transport, and local government. So it's actually pretty good, and we've got a whole lot covered between us, and everyone seems pretty happy.
Well, people who come in, I mean, in many ways, the Greens are still like an independent crossbench in a parliament. They have to convince all sorts of people, but you'd have your own policies and you'd want to see some of those advanced in a significant way. Do you harbour a hope that particular policies, and everyone, of course, is wanting to get to net zero by 2050, and lots of people have been complaining that we don't look like getting there in Western Australia. I mean, do you have strategies about how you can try and force issues that are dear to the Greens' heart?
Yes. So there's a couple of ways. So obviously there'll be a couple of things, key issues that we'll want to talk to government about and say, look, hopefully, this is probably one of coming through Fremantle was, one of the key issues that we saw in this part of the world during the state election was fracking in the Kimberley and wanting a ban on that. And we'll be saying to government, look, surely you heard that loud and clear. You said yourselves, there's no fracking. You don't really support fracking. You just kind of, it's just no ban because you don't want to pay out those who have been doing exploration there. But I think there's an opportunity for government to actually show leadership and actually say we are going to actually properly ban fracking, non-conventional gas extraction in this state. So I'm hoping there's some what I would call low-hanging fruit wins, which are actually have the support of Labor, most Labor supporters anyway, and ones that I think. Many Labor voters would like to see their own government go and do. And then there's other ones where government will be pushing through legislation which will try and make it better. And climate's a really good example of that. So we had a climate bill in the last parliament, which was introduced in late 2023, never got debated. in the lower house or the upper house. And so that, now that Parliament's prorogued, that bill has to start
again. It's gone.
Yep. Yeah. I expect that that bill will come back. Now, the upside of this is that there's an upside now for us to say, well, we'll support that bill. We support climate action, but we're not going to support a bill that actually means you don't do anything this decade and do all your climate action in the 2040s, which is sometimes was my reading of what they were proposing, and no one's really held to account. We're actually saying we want really clear targets, you know, for this decade and clear actions for this decade and really good transparency around that. And so that's the kind of amendments that we would move to a government bill, and if they wanted our support for that bill, they would need to do it. Because I suspect you'll find that the Liberal Party may take more of a hard line now and actually try to differentiate themselves from government on some of these key issues. We've certainly seen that from the Dutton side. Whether the WA Liberals take a similar angle will be interesting to see.
The upper houses right around the country, and the national one, have pretty good committee systems in place. A long time ago, when I was one of the council assisting the WA Inc inquiry, we were all pushing for a more active Parliament, particularly in the upper house and its committee system, to oversight government. What's been your experience with those committees, and how do you see them working with the Greens wanting to presumably activate some things?
Well, actually, in fairness with government, they kept one convention in the last Parliament, which was the Finance and Estimates Committee, which has had a long-term convention of being not government-controlled. So in the last Parliament, there were two Libs and two Labour on that committee, and then I was the fifth member. So that was the only part of the whole Parliament that the Labor Party didn't dominate. And we got to do really good things with that. So we did inquiry into homelessness and how effective government responses were into that, into the greyhound industry, things like that which weren't necessarily government policy or government supported, but we actually got a really good tripartisan responses to those kinds of things. And that's where the committee stuff's so important. So the committee system's so different to the Parliament, where it's where really, because it's often quite, it's done behind closed doors, so all the party posturing falls away. And people can actually have frank conversations around it. It's actually the way Parliament should work, to be honest.
It becomes a bit evidence-based, doesn't it?
It does. Maybe you actually look at the evidence.
Terrible thought.
It's actually quite refreshing, because the Parliament sometimes feels deeply broken, but the committee system's still pretty good. And given Labor won't control the upper house anymore, look, there will be an opportunity for some kinds of inquiries that could be initiated by the opposition, the crossbench, coming together to say, we want an inquiry into this. You know, look, and you can't help but think on the back of the what we saw with the electoral debacle, that will be, well, you'd hope government would support that too, but if government doesn't, then certainly that's something that we've indicated we will be working together to form an inquiry into.
I've got the impression from reading the media that it'll be a bipartisan desire to see what happened,
yes,
not just in Fremantle, but particularly down here.
Yeah.
In terms of the big issues, as you and the Greens see it for this upcoming Parliament, what are going to be the big policy issues? We have a government that, the Cook government, which encouraged and succeeded in having Prime Minister Albanese shelved the nature positive legislation in Canberra. I've had articles posted on the Shipping News about it. It's very disappointing. But is that going to be an area in which you find yourself tussling with the present government?
Yeah, look, it is. I mean, I must say, there are, at times, this Labor government behaves surprisingly. I'm trying to think of the appropriate word for it. I mean, framing it in left and right terms isn't that useful, they're so extremely pro-industry on some of these key issues, and we've seen it in that kind of weirdly doing industry's bidding when it comes to gas extraction, but also when it comes to other environmental issues. And I feel like that's out of step with what many West Australians expect. I mean, I appreciate Fremantle's a bit of a different beast sometimes in terms of what our community expects, but it was pretty loud and clear that Simone must have got a wake-up call kind of saying, hey, we expect better than that on environment. And certainly I think fracking and gas generally and fossil fuels was a really big part of that.
Brad, when you come to trying to electrify, which seemed to always be the argument, and I think still is, for getting rid of fossil fuels and and getting to net zero. How do you think the state is doing?
Actually, it's not doing that well. Is the reality. And I find this, it's really interesting because there is so much hype around the renewable energy wave is coming. But one of my jobs in the parliament is to ask questions and look at the evidence. And you know, we've literally been talking about a wave of renewable energy projects coming now for about a decade. But in this decade, certainly in the last term, only one large-scale renewable energy project was completed in WA. And there are none which are likely to be completed this year. So we're seeing very slow trickle. In fact, I've mapped it out, and actually by the end of the decade, we're only going to see a couple more, because the lead time of a big wind project, to take an example, is 5 or 6 years from getting approvals all the way through to actually seeing it connect to the grid. So it's quite a confusing, because we have the best wind, sun, and land resources to build to be a renewable energy superpower, but we're not doing that. So look, and I think government actually wants to, I think this is actually part of their confusion around focusing so much on gas, focusing on a whole bunch of other things. I think they've actually almost just not enabled, and actually got in the way. And we've seen, the feedback from industry is, government agencies like Western Power and Synergy make it very difficult. We're seeing government even putting in place policies which they don't want to admit are even real, but I think they finally admitted. So for example, was one that's coming later this year, which they haven't made public yet, but is going to happen, which is a $100,000 per megawatt charge on new energy projects. Now, so if you've got a standard project that's 100 megawatts, you have a $10 million upfront tax. And energy providers are quite literally saying, well, we just won't do it here, then we'll do it on the Eastern Seaboard. So, because, these are big companies with capital who can choose where they put their projects. And WA is kind of dealing itself out of many ways out of this transition. And we're seeing so many projects go overseas and interstate because we haven't got our policy settings right and aren't creating an enabling environment. Look, and that comes down to the fact we're the only state without a 2030 emissions target and without a 2030 renewable energy target. And without that certainty, industry goes somewhere else.
We're no doubt going to hear a lot more from the Greens on topics like that. You mentioned homelessness earlier and the inquiry in the Upper House. It's a challenge right around the country. It's not only people living rough, it's just the whole social housing question.
Yeah.
At a time, and so many things get attributed to COVID 5 years ago now, trying to get things built, getting skilled tradesmen. I feel sorry for the ministers who've got the responsibility for trying to have these things happen in any sort of proper time. We have seen builders falling over all the time. But do you think, from what you've seen, that there's some light at the end of the tunnel in alleviating the homelessness problem?
No, I don't think there is. In fact, all the data will say that the gap in terms of housing supply and need is going to get bigger. So, and that is a big concern. We've got, this is industry data says that's going to widen out to 25,000-27,000 homes. And with that, you see continual pressure. Look, and government is throwing a lot of money at social housing and crisis housing. But as I say, and I've said many times, we cannot build our way out of this crisis alone. We have to build. Don't get me wrong. It's essential. We've got to get on. But we've got to get much smarter than that around actually how we use our homes and use our buildings and get creative and clever. There are enough bedrooms, in fact, way more than enough bedrooms in Western Australia right now for everyone to have somewhere safe to sleep. In fact, there's enough homes for everyone to have somewhere safe to sleep. Just really unequally distributed. And this has been, so whilst the minister says he's pulling every lever, what hasn't happened is some of those braver decisions. Look at it, I'll pick one that we've been going on about and other states have done, which is around Airbnbs. So going back a decade, there were no, people know, very few Airbnbs in Western Australia. There's now more than 10,000. And most of those were long-term homes. And many of those are in Perth, and many of those are in Fremantle. Places that, that were people's houses in Fremantle are now Airbnbs. And there is no, the government passed some legislation on this, but it completely lacked courage. All they did was create a list. So they knew how many there were. And I was like, well, actually Airbnb is a website that will tell you how many there are. I can Google it right now. So you're not getting that, you might get slightly finer grain information. But nothing to actually encourage those short-term houses back into the long-term market. That's not true. They did, they threw millions of dollars at it, and they got 281 of them back in by throwing $7 million at, but there's no sticks. All just the carrot. So there are things we can do, and this is, I think, if we're serious about this housing crisis, we should do, but they're going to require much more political courage and a willingness to make some people grumpy. And that seems to be, this government isn't willing to do that.
Changing the topic slightly, John Quigley fought pretty hard to get in new political finance disclosure laws, which kicked in, I think, this time. We were watching them, were the political parties keeping an eye on who was putting money in? How did it all work from your perspective?
Well, this is actually laws that had some good parts to them, because at least we've got transparency now, to a certain extent. And it was almost comical because, we saw exactly what we knew, is that the fossil fuel companies, the Woodsides of the world, and the property developing companies, the Sallys of the world, were all giving lots of money to both major parties. I actually moved an amendment to that legislation, which wasn't supported by either party, which was actually that that certain kinds of donation should be banned. And that included property developers and fossil fuels and gambling and tobacco but the only thing that is banned is foreign. So they banned foreign donations, but if it's a domestic donation, then you can take that money. I'm like, people don't give money because they just like you. They expect something in return. And the idea that we corrupt our democratic process through that, I think is deeply problematic. When I was mayor, if I got any donation above $300, I had to excuse myself from voting on that issue. We are seeing these political parties get tens of thousands, in fact, millions over time from these key players, and they're the same people who are regulating them and voting on legislation that affects them. And I think that's broken and shouldn't happen.
So I take it from what you've said, you'd still like to see amendments like you proposed brought into play.
Yeah, I think this is best practice around actually banning those kind of donations, but also I'll go further and saying, when you leave Parliament, you can't go on the board or work for an industry that you were regulating or involved with when you're in Parliament. Democracy is viewed, it's under threat, and I think it is an opportunity to strengthen it, not weaken it, through what we do. And I think in a place like WA, we've got a capacity to do that and do the right thing. And it's actually just saying, let's take the best around the world and do it here. There's no reason why we can't.
The revolving door syndrome, as you just described, it, ministers or politicians who go out and have a new job the next day, they're on a board, they're an advisor, they also become lobbyists. I mean, would you expect there to be changes in the lobbying laws?
Well, there should be. It's pretty outrageous what we see, but it's both ways too. So there are people, who are working for property developers who now end up on the EPA or on the WPC. It's just not a healthy way of running a state. We actually want people making good decisions, not on who they know and who they're trying to keep happy, but on actually what's good for everybody, not their donors or their mates. So this is some of the right stuff to do. And I think there's an opportunity for the Parliament to push this. And I'm hoping with a new, more balanced Parliament, we can actually have these discussions and make those improvements.
Just coming back to your own group, as you've said, a couple of you have some parliamentary experience now, and you come in. Have you been surprised in your 4 years as to the way the Parliament works, or the upper house in particular? Are there things that you just think Blind Freddy would be calling out and wanting to see changed, or has it worked pretty reasonably from your point of view?
Oh, look, it didn't work at all last 4 years. I mean, I mean, I think it cost $50,000 a day to run the parliament, and I didn't wonder what purpose it was, what value it was adding to anything really, other than, you know. I mean, look, that said, I got to ask questions. We have these thing called questions without notice, so I can ask a question by 10 o'clock in the morning and I get an answer by 4:30 in the afternoon, which is great. And you can actually make, I think, holding governments to account through those kind of questions and other things is really important. But now look, I think parliaments would work much better if there wasn't political parties. I almost got the sense that they were designed before there was political parties, because the debate that happens is kind of strangely, no one's really listening. I mean, that was probably my weirdest experience was when I got to parliament and realised it was very, when I was on the Fremantle Council, we would debate, but people would listen and change their mind. When I get up and debate in the parliament, the only person who's listening is the Hansard reporter who's taking notes. Everybody else is on their phone or having a chat. So it's quite disconcerting, quite having a very well-prepared argument that you realise that nobody's listening to.
Well, that would particularly be the case if one party completely dominated,
yeah,
and they knew what the outcome was they were voting for, and they didn't need to stop and listen or,
yeah, that's right,
debate.
Yeah.
That might change conceivably this time around.
Yeah, look, I hope so. And I think there is a real opportunity for that. Look, I think parliaments still probably don't work as designed. I still think even when we do negotiate with Labor, say, for example, on amendments or changes to legislation, that will be what they call happening behind the chair, and that's the term for you do that out of the parliament, and then you agree, and then you come into the parliament to vote on that. I'm yet to see a single person change their mind or their vote after a debate on the floor of the parliament, but I think it would be great if it did.
Well, in many ways, no one was much surprised at the outcome of this election, that the Greens finished up getting their 4 seats in the upper house, that the numbers worked out in the upper house pretty much the way they did. I suppose the greatest surprise for many commentators was that the Libs didn't pull back further.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did. And look, it might be a surprising thing for a progressive like me to say, but I actually think that's a bit of a shame in some ways. I actually think a healthy democracy is actually when you've got a strong opposition. I'm pretty sure that we'll be a strong crossbench, but I do think that it was not healthy for Western Australia what happened the last few years. And look, they'll be a bit stronger, but I just think you've got better government when you've got a good strong opposition asking the right questions. But it was interesting. And look, I think the explanation for this, I think, is part that Labor did an extremely good job of getting very close to the Liberal Party on most policies. They literally gave the Liberal Party nowhere to move. Someone in the upper house used to joke to me that he said McGowan was in, that McGowan was the best Liberal Premier that this state has had for a long time. And then we'd go on to say this is one of the best Liberal governments, even though, because he was Liberal, because literally they had nowhere else to go. I think that's what, I mean, in many ways what they did. And I think that was the cleverness of their strategy. Now, that's very good politics. I guess the question though, is that good policy, and is that giving good outcomes on some of the key challenges that we face, be it from housing to homelessness to climate, you know, to our environment? I don't think it is. That's the most disappointing part for me.
Well, you've got 4 years ahead, relatively youthful group of Greens. You're looking very fit, Brad. You have to work this, I imagine. Do you have advisors who come in and tell you to keep up your yoga and make sure you go swimming each morning?
The parliament has a gym in the basement, which is very handy. And when a really boring debate is on, no one else seems to use it very much. So I go down there and I just put the debate on the TV in the gym. And you can get a decent workout in whilst everyone's just arguing with each other about something you don't really care about.
Brad Pittard, I think that might be the takeaway observation from this interview. What happens down in the parliamentary gym while the debate's going on upstairs?
It was before Mark McGowan left the parliament, it was almost him, only him and I used it, I think. And then he left and it was like, who's going to be in the gym with me now?
I'm sure you'll find somebody to join you this year.
Right. I think my Greens colleagues will hopefully join me at least.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining me today and sharing all of these views.
Thanks, Michael.